Essay number one. The Bodhisattva asks. Part one. There's no two ways about love. It's true what they say about love. Come what may, it's just that way. There's no two ways about love. The schemes that you're dreaming of fit into your world like a glove. Once you're hooked, your goose is cooked. There's no two ways about love. Those are some lines from a song called There's No Two Ways About Love, which Lena Horne sings to Cab Calloway's accompaniment in the 1943 classic movie Stormy Weather. It is clearly a B-side song, at least by comparison to some of the other blockbusters in that movie, including the title song. The second stanza I quote is particularly clunky. I couldn't even find a copy of the lyrics with a Google search, including one Lena Horne reservoir that cataloged over 500 of her songs. I recorded a cover of this song a couple of years ago and used it as the title for the playlist that song appears in. So I must have found the lyrics somewhere, or maybe just copied them out listening to the Horne YouTube from the movie, like I did today. All of which is to say that it is not a particularly well-known, well-made, or memorable song. Except to me, these last few years. I'm not even sure why. Something about the no two ways business. I like the complexity of it. The implication that while two-wayness may be the way of the world in every other respect, at least with love, is not. Or something like that. I just happened to listen to that playlist while I was taking a bath today and knew I wanted to use it to open this essay, even though it seems a very loose fit, if it is a fit at all. Only time will tell if I can make it all work for you. I already know it works for me, on a level that remains beneath my consciousness right now. So whatever the result of this work, I'll still be satisfied, even if, for my lack of verbal ingenuity, you are not. The topic of this essay seems, even to me at the outset, to be at odds with the gist of this song, in that it is all about two ways. So I have my work cut out for me. I'll begin with a dream I had a couple of months ago, one I took note of at the time and have had in the back of my mind since. The scene of the dream is a Buddhist monastery where I am taking some sort of a test concerning my level of enlightenment. I had been reading a lot of Taoist texts this spring and summer, so the dream seemed in keeping with what was on my mind, not out of the blue or overly esoteric, I mean. The question the Bodhisattva asks is, what is your understanding of the Koan paradox? I can't remember what the koan was or what sort of paradox it captured, but it had something to do with the desire for perfection. And I answered this way. The desire for perfection is always inflected by an understanding that human nature is by definition imperfect, and therefore the goal is unattainable. So at every step along the way, one has to confront the question, why should I even bother when what I seek cannot ever be found? You can feel almost viscerally the two-way tension in my response, the sense that one is always conflicted about how to pursue the highest human ambitions, that every path toward them has a two-ways aspect, one urging you forward, the other warning you back. Never one or the other, always both. The Bodhisattva said I had passed the test and was ready to resume my path in the world. He did not say that I had achieved enlightenment, or even if that was possible for me, based on what I said. Desire is, after all, I can see now, what needs to be overcome to achieve enlightenment. So, in some sense, even the desire for perfection is profane. I'm surprised the Bodhisattva didn't take off points from my answer for failing to acknowledge and account for that. Then again, maybe he was so disappointed in it that I actually failed the test and was sent off so he'd be rid of me. Again, no clear way to know which of these two ways his intentions pointed, or both. But he did indicate it was time for me to go off on my own. The existential problem my response points to is one endemic to human enterprise in this world, most especially in relation to personal ethical choices. We never have any absolutely reliable way of knowing exactly what the best or even better course is. Not at least once we become conscious of more than one of the historically significant menus for guiding our behavior. By contrast, I mean with a complete obeisance to one preferred script, always deferring to outside authorities to interpret its complexities for us. But even if we only know one such text, the Bible, say, or the Quran, there are still profound disagreements among experts as to what they recommend or require. Should I pray for lost souls or pillage a village? Should I sing from a minaret or detonate a bomb in a public plaza? Or both? You can't end up with more extreme two ways than that, both derived from texts that are commonly shared by all readers. And once we step away from such fixed matrices, most especially into arenas that foster agnosticism, we are always left with the conundrum of whether or not there is any reason to believe we can ever know what is good, let alone see a good reason to do it. I really like mental states like the one induced by this kind of ambivalence. On the ethical side, such two-way murkiness mandates an almost moment-by-moment series of choices about how or whether one wants to continue to invest energy in an enterprise that appears to be futile. One that requires discipline, dedication, and sacrifice at the expense of more worldly rewards. One where it's possible when it's all over and you see the light, you might think, what a chump I was. I could have been luxuriating in selfish pleasures. Instead, I had a V8. In other words, one where there are always two incompatible and competing ways in the picture, and we need to navigate a pathway through them. Part 2. So, speaking of pathways, if I walk in the pathway of duty, if I work till the close of the day, I shall see the great king in all his beauty when I've gone the last mile of the way. I zoom weekly with my siblings and a family friend. One of our recent tasks was to pick a snippet from each of three songs we thought about often and, over a three-week period, explain why. I picked these lines for my final entry, which go through my mind maybe three or four times a week, always via the remembered voice of Sam Cooke, who sings this gospel tune during his stint as a very young man with the Soul Stirrers. It is a very poignant song for me, at least in part because of this next stanza. Cooke doesn't sing it, but I found it a few years ago when I wanted to record a cover of the song. And by the way, if you want to cover a song, don't pick one Sam Cooke song. No matter how good you are, and I'm not very good, you will never be able to reclaim the song from Sam Cooke. In any case, here is that stanza, one that resonates with me, as I suppose it would for anyone of my age who has endured great losses, which is pretty much anyone of my age, I guess, almost by definition. Hear the dearest of ties we must sever. Tears of sorrow are seen every day, but no sickness, no sighing forever, when I've gone the last mile of the way. While the song does capture the sense of tension anyone trying to stay on a good path feels in a world that doesn't reward such endeavors, it is still quite clear, at the end of both of these stanzas, that once the last mile is passed, there will be ample rewards on some other side. But just by happenstance, when I was learning this song, I misread the final line of the first stanza, turning the statement into a question, "Shall I see?" instead of "I shall see." I actually prefer my mistaken version for my personal journey, in that it carries the same two-way ambivalence as the Zen koan, "I can't any longer remember." In other words, if you're not sure there will be any reward at all in some promised future, and you know that doing good does not render external rewards in the present, why would you choose such a path? In practice, once you do, if you have, you know that you have that question hauntingly in mind at every step along the way. The advantage of having made it to the last mile with the commitment intact is that at least the mission's almost over, whatever the outcome. And you're not likely to be too tempted to abandon it, given the sort of paltry pleasures that old age proffers, at least by comparison to those of youth. This calls suddenly to my mind a line from a bluegrass song I really like, "The Far Side Banks of Jordan" by the Carter family. "Lures of this old world have ceased to make me want to stay." Sung by an old man who fears he might pass first, leaving his wife grieving. At one of my medical appointments after my wife died, the doctor asked how I was handling it emotionally. I said, with a smile, "I was doing great," and quoted that line, as if to say, there was not much difference to me right then between living and dying. I was sanguine about both. Fortunately, she understood that my smile was a sign of wisdom, not depression. I know this paragraph is only tenuously connected to what preceded it, but it offers a good last mile for this section tonight. I'll just have to wait and see what door it might open next tomorrow morning. Part 3. So, speaking of doors, "Ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened." That's Matthew 7:8. Jesus delivers this famous promise as part of his Sermon on the Mount, at least according to Matthew's version. I assume that everyone else's experience is like mine in the sense that you have at points in your life prayed fervently for something to be given or found or opened unto you, and it wasn't. The after effect is a baffled, sometimes depressed quandary, one that is at least vaguely analogous to the ones I've written about thus far. There seems on the face of it to be no two ways about it, but there are. Something you wanted to happen didn't, or didn't want to happen, did. What do you make of this promise then? And how do you map a path forward? This whole section of the sermon has primarily to do with faith, as in having it confidently, and with prayer secondarily, as an exercise of faith. So, when a prayer is not answered, we can assume, as theologians have explained, that either our faith is defective or that what we ask for is not in God's will. But really, it's almost impossible to see how one's own faith is weak, from the inside, I mean, when it is the best version of it we can muster. And if God's will is the determining factor, why would we have to pray for it at all? In that his will would be done in any case, whether we asked, sought, or knocked. Again, We have to decide not just how we want to proceed in the moment of such a crisis in relation to asking for such outside intervention, I mean, but at every future moment we have to live in the shadow of that perceived loss. That takes stamina, a form of hobbled faith that may not lead to answered prayers, but keeps us wobbling on the path toward an impossible perfection, whether or not we expect to see the glory after the last mile has passed. When I'm puzzled by one of Jesus' almost always puzzling pronouncements, I like to look at the context for it. This one is inserted in Matthew between a series of warnings about being judgmental and a series of examples of how to give gifts. So maybe the key to coping with unopened doors is not to close doors to others. And the solution to not receiving is to give. I just thought up that succinct sentence right here. But it conveys a set of ethical imperatives that became abundantly clear to me in the aftermath of my wife's passing. That is, the way to cope with the failure of others to reach out was to reach out to others in need. And the way to cope with missing gifts was to make sure they were not missing for others who crossed your path. I've written about this more extensively elsewhere in Coming to Terms and This Fall, so I won't go into detail about it here. I just happened to be preoccupied today with two very specific things I prayed and hoped for most of my life, neither of which happened to my satisfaction. A telling word there, to be sure. I don't need or even want either of them any longer. But the shadow such unanswered prayers cast is a long and dark one. I'm going to go to bed now because I feel very frustrated by this troubling example of two-wayness. I'm thinking that by tomorrow morning, I won't be as conflicted, or at least not conflicted in the same way. Part 4. So, speaking of frustration with conflict, here is the most famous section of Paul's most famous letter, his first missive to the troublesome Corinthians. If I speak in the tongues of men or angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now, we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. I was half right. I'm still conflicted, but not conflicted in the same way this morning. I had a bunch of weird dreams that, as usual, followed an emotional progression from dusk to dawn, and I woke up laughing with an image in my head of a list of possible translations of a passage from Ecclesiastes, the first of which was, "Wow, no work, gonna be all right, gonna be okay." I think I can safely say, without checking, that that's not quite textually accurate. More like a combination of Paul Kameen and Keb Moe. It seems to me that even my dreams are most often both way, two ways, at least the ones I remember. But for some reason, last night's, which, except for that quote and the conversational context it was a part of, too complicated and loony to document here, I don't remember the details of, did show me a way back to the no two ways subject, via Paul's enthralling paean to love in this letter, which was also, but vaguely, on my mind as I woke up, so I went and read it. The second paragraph above is, of course, the most famous. But I quoted that whole section because, as I said, for me at least, understanding how to implement an ethical imperative from any significant source requires looking at the context. This is, after all, a letter designed to tamp down division in the early church, in large part an express challenge to Paul's authority, which he claims is based on revelation. The early church was a wonderfully turbulent entity, more a community, or an array of communities, than an institution. All kinds of competing theories and texts and values and systems, also spiritually, culturally, and rhetorically generative. So unlike the rule-based, hidebound, ultra-patriarchy it turned into once the threat of death for practitioners was lifted by Constantine about 300 years hence. Can't beat that threat of death thing for bringing focus and intensity to one's ethical and spiritual enterprise in this world. Look at the difference, for example, between existentialism in the French resistance during World War II and what it turned into in the 50s and 60s. The immediate context provided by Paul's mid-level peroration of biblical proportion seems clear to me. He is saying that everything, including him and his apparently externally sanctioned authority, will pass. So get over it, friends. You need some sort of leader, and right now it's me. But the only durable remnant of his regime, and everything and anything else for that matter, is and will be love. Which gets me back to the one-way street I've been looking for, the point where Paul, both the original and me, and Lena Horne meet on common ground. As to my apparently unanswered prayers, well, that too is a get-over-it matter. Who cares? At least now, this late in the game. Stop talking, thinking, reasoning as a child, Paul. Faith and hope, which the other Paul addresses earlier in the letter, the former in considerable detail, the latter more indirectly, are essential, of course, no matter the circumstances, but only because they serve as the foundation for love, the greatest. I've been writing about love in one way or another for over 6 years now, starting with this fall, my Keystone book. I can't repeat here all I've said about it there or in the other 6 books of personal essays I've cobbled together, but right from the outset, the stunned shock I felt the moment I found my wife lifeless when I came home from work plunged me into a river of tears that seems never to find a sea willing once and for all to receive everything it needs to empty from its mouth, all these words settling into silence and peace. But I am certain that whether those torrents quiet or pour, whether they ever find a place to rest in wider and deeper waters. What endures is the intense overwhelm of love that remained in that moment for her, for myself, my family, for everything in the universe, really. The one and only thing left after everything else was boiled off in those first few seconds of grief. Paul says three things remain after his long discourse. But I think he, like me, knows there is only one. I have lived long stretches without hope, and I still live, for the most part, without faith. I can assure you that you can survive as an ethical presence in this world, which I think I have, without copious amounts of those two, or any at all sometimes, as long as you have love, the greatest, the only thing in this whole universe, at least as I've experienced it, which is one, the only one that's always and only one. The other Paul says love is the way to know fully and be fully known. For him, though, that state of awareness, I'll call it enlightenment, at least in its more perfect form, can only be achieved after the last mile has been fully walked on the other side. I disagree. If there is another side, I think the one we're on here is where we're supposed to learn how to love, especially how to keep giving it when it's not forthcoming. Love is the way humans become godly. And it works that way, no matter what God you might imagine, or even if you cannot imagine one at all. If I had to answer the Bodhisattva's question now, I think I'd say exactly what I said, except I'd add that if you can learn how to love truly and deeply, which is a worthy aspiration in this world, the highest aspiration really, and is achievable, I am certain, then answering that perpetual question about how to proceed moment by moment in the face of all those wonky two-waynesses is easy. The answer will always be yes, without question, no two ways about it, which gets at least me, if not you, back where I started, with Lena Horne and Cab Calloway, that swanky nightclub setting rendered in black and white, explaining simply how we can cope with all the stupid stormy weather we, for some unfathomable reason, have to endure while we're here.